right now, what we're during the 3 weeks, which represent the time between Shivasa B'Tamuz and Tisha B'Av, specific or particular attention has to be paid to the way that people treat one another. Within the Jewish community, if you'll ask for the core of brothers not getting along, it goes back to the story of Yosef and the brothers. Obviously, this is not the first case in the Bible that siblings don't get along. There was a Cain and Abel before that. The difference, of course, is that Cain and Abel live at a time and a place that the expectations are perhaps somewhat different. Over here we have a man named Abraham, a man who finds God, son Isaac, grandson Jacob. We already have three generations of people who have a relationship with God. And after these three generations, Yaakov has a whole bunch of children. And it's interesting and important for us to note that not all of Avraham's children made it. Not all of Yitzchak's children make it. Yaakov's children, despite mistakes that they make, and they do, and they're human, they all are part of our spiritual legacy, and our history, and therefore our legacy. These people are our spiritual heroes, despite the mistakes that they make. Which means a person like Yishmael, he no longer remains part of the family. There's a different line, relatives, cousins, but it's not the same. Esav, same thing, separates, becomes something else. Yaakov's 12 children, who I've already stressed, are not perfect. Despite their imperfection, they are the Jewish people. Those are the 12 that go down to Egypt. Those are the ones who get married and have children. And those are the ones who eventually leave Egypt. Those are the ones who accept the Torah. They're descendants who enter into the land of Israel. When we speak of the people of Israel, these are they. Now, despite all this, and I said, or maybe because of all this, when we study, we have to be quite careful. We have to look at things that they did. We have to understand their mistakes. We have to see their greatness. The story of Joseph and the brothers is the prototype and the core of all hatred that exists within the community. At the end of last week's parsha, we read about the various sin offerings that are brought. It says, Sir, Izim, Achad, Lachatat. A goat is brought as a sin offering. Why is a goat a sin offering? We're told that a goat was used within the sale of Joseph, and therefore, every single holiday, when we want to celebrate, when we feel like there's something good which is happening, we have to remember that there was a sale of Joseph. That's something that we cannot forget. It's like the seeds of that sale were planted, things grow because of those seeds, and we have to be aware of it. In fact, when we look throughout Jewish history, and we find there were episodes which repeat themselves of Jews making mistakes, and the mistake of fundamentally lacking the proper type of respect and relationship within the community, we have to remember that the core for this goes back to Joseph and the brothers. That's what the rabbis are trying to say over here. Is that we need to keep on paying attention to it. I don't know if you remember from the story which is told in the prayers on Yom Kippur. They were told that there were these 10 great rabbis, these 10 martyrs, and the Roman leader turns to them and says, he reads through the Torah, and he says, what is the punishment for kidnapping? And the response of the rabbis is that the kidnapper should be put to death. So he asks, well, you kidnapped your brother Joseph. Why were the brothers not put to death? It's a very harsh question. You know what the rabbis answered? We don't have an answer for you. We don't know what to say. Give us 3 days. And the world which which the rabbis lived in was such, where it was a mystical world. One of them, Rabbi Yishmael, Kohen Gadol, he utters the name of God, and according to the description there, he arises and his soul goes up into heaven, and he asks the heavenly court, what is this? And the response that he gets, it's a decree from God. Now, without going into these elements of how does one's soul get up into heaven and what's going on with that, the simplest message that I see over here, that I hear from this, is that it was a decree from God that post-Second Temple, there still needs to be some sort of I don't want to call it divine retribution, but the problem which caused the destruction, the problem which existed so long ago between Joseph and his brothers was still around. And you know what? You don't have to be a theologian to appreciate that the problem is still around today. It's one of the problems which has haunted us throughout our history. You know, the Talmud tells us that any generation where the temple's not rebuilt has no right to say that we're better than the generation where it was destroyed. Because if we were better than that generation, it'd be rebuilt. Talmud tells us the second temple is destroyed because people hated one another. If people hated one another, then, and the temple has not been rebuilt. And again, if you really want the ability to focus a little bit more, maybe it is positive to listen to the radio or to read the newspapers and see what's going on right now. Jerusalem is under siege right now. It's just an amazing thing, you know, because sometimes Jews get like this false impression about themselves and about their people and about their land. You know, are we really all that important and we have this inflated appreciation of ourselves? And then when we do appreciate that the whole world is looking at Jerusalem right now, and the whole world is trying to determine what will be the future of Jerusalem, we realize that maybe our impression is not all that inflated. Maybe there is something very holy over here. Maybe there is something very special. But other people want Jerusalem. And the reason that people want Jerusalem is because they perhaps appreciate the holiness to it. But more profoundly, why is it that we don't deserve Jerusalem? That's the deeper issue. We're told the core of the problem goes back to Joseph and the brothers. And I want to go one step deeper right now. We're told that the first temple is destroyed because of three things. Because the people were guilty of murder, they were guilty of sexual sins, they were guilty of idolatry. We're told the second temple was destroyed because they hated one another. The Talmud therefore says, you learn from this that hating one another is just as bad as murder, idolatry, and sexual sins. There's another passage of the Talmud that says that Lashon Hara, speaking about other people, is as bad as murder, idolatry, and sexual sins. The Chafetz Chaim said, well, if I use mathematics over here, I believe this is the associative principle, that if hating one another is as bad as murder, idolatry, and sexual sins, and if speaking Lashon Hara, speaking about people, is like murder, idolatry, and sexual sins, therefore, Lashon Hara and hating one another are identical to one another. And he therefore said, when it says that people, that the second temple was destroyed because they hated one another, what does it mean they hated one another? How does hating one another manifest itself? Meaning hating one another is more often than not going to be an inner emotion that I have. I hate somebody. How does it manifest itself? So the truth is it can manifest itself in all types of ways. The Chafetz Chaim claimed that the simplest way that it would manifest itself would be speaking about other people. I want something very practical. What is inside me that brings me to have to put somebody else down? To have to tell stories about somebody else? To have to spread gossip about somebody else? Well, obviously one side of it would be basic insecurity on my part, but it's this desire to bring this other person down as well. Say that being that I don't accomplish all that I think I should accomplish, let me rip his accomplishments as well. Which means that the core of where Lashon Hara comes from, where gossip comes from, the core of it, comes from hatred of one person to another. You had a comment? Question?
So ask, does this just include Jews hating Jews, or does it include Jews hating anybody else, Gentiles, etc.?
Certainly the starting point for this is Jews hating Jews. Because, you know, it's one thing if one family doesn't get along with a different family. It's quite another thing if within one family people don't get along, which means if you can't even create the basic structure of a family, then what hope do we possibly have for elevating the world? The Jewish way has always been, instead of, you know, taking out advertisements and PR campaigns and trying to affect other people, it's always been more so of an attempt to try to affect ourselves first. Let me first affect myself, let me then try to affect other people around me and try to grow out. But I think that, the sort of approach to go on an evangelical mission and just try to change everybody else without really causing personal change within is something which will eventually be seen as, you know, in a cynical light. Because it's not serious. I think that the Jewish ideal has always been one to create a greater society. See, people sometimes look at Judaism and say, it's supposed to be a light unto the nations. Is that a commandment to be a light unto the nations, or is that a destiny? It's not one of the 613 commandments. But you know what? It could be stronger than all the other commandments. It could be that's what it's all about. You know what? Let me help you understand this concept a little bit better. Judaism is a very strange religion. It's strange in the sense that it doesn't believe that it should have existed. Does that sound strange? Sort of like an accident. Now, accident isn't a good enough word, which means God created a Garden of Eden. God commanded Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve live up to their potential. The world takes a completely different course. Adam and Eve fail, so now it creates a new reality. If Noah would have lived up to a different sort of standard than he did, the world would have taken a completely different course. Eventually, it is Abraham who lives up to this standard, while others don't. Abraham, therefore, takes responsibility, and God says, okay, let me make a covenant with Abraham and his descendants, and they will now have to live up to the standard, not because I don't care about the rest of the world. Of course God cares about the rest of the world. But God says, okay, here is a family that will be able to live to a higher standard in order to teach and inspire the rest of the world. The question is, how does it go about happening? And sometimes people ask, or they have difficulties with Judaism, they say, you know, how could it be that the Jews are a chosen people? It's a very funny thing. I think every religion believes that they're a chosen people. Jews are very bothered by this, that Jews can consider themselves to be chosen. When we say chosen, what does that mean? It means that we are chosen for a particular responsibility. It doesn't mean that we're better. It doesn't mean we're smarter or richer or better looking or whatever else may be. It means that we have a responsibility. And that responsibility is to teach the nations of the world. Now, how do you do that? Is the best way of education just going out and teaching people or living by an example? Which means the Jews entered into this land and they were told to live by an example. The problem is that when we didn't live up to the standards that were set, and we ended up copying the other nations of the world, at that point, that temple could no longer last. And we were no longer living up to our standards, so God says, you're not affecting the nations of the world, so now go into exile and try to catch their attention. Because if we create a society which is no better than any other society, then why would anybody pay attention to us? So the purpose of exile is one that if we cannot accomplish as a nation, that perhaps we can accomplish as individuals. But let's not make no mistake about it. Exile is a punishment. But exile is not just a punishment, it's also a result of when we're not living up to our standards. We got a second opportunity, the second temple was built, we come back to the land, and we're supposed to create an advanced moral society which will affect the rest of the world. Once again, we don't live up to the standards we're supposed to live, and we go into exile again. And now we're given more time to go and affect people on a personal level. Maimonides has a very strange, perhaps for some people disturbing, concept about a Christianity and Islam. He says that these are part of God's plan. Now, you have to be very careful. Does that mean that Maimonides accepts Christianity and Islam as being valid? Absolutely not. He thinks that they're both very mistaken, each in its own proper way, in a particular way. But why does he say it's part of God's plan? Think about it. 4,000 years ago, correct? 4,000 years ago, Abraham is the only monotheist in the world. God takes him out one night and shows him the stars in the sky and says, your descendants will be more numerous than that. Is that true today? Followers of Abraham? Yeah, it is. Think about it. How many hundreds of millions of people, billions of people, believe in one God today? Which means Maimonides says that when the Jews did not live up to their standards, God says, my plan will take place. What Islam and Christianity did is it took pagans and brought them in the ballpark. Say the book, meaning Maimonides in the Guide for the Perplexed has an interesting metaphor. He says people that are pagan are walking the wrong way. People that are monotheists are walking towards the palace. Depending on intellectual understanding and religious sensitivity, a person will eventually be able to either enter into the palace, enter into the inner chamber of the palace, and maybe even get to see the king. He believes that people that are monotheists are walking in the right direction. He believes that people that are polytheists are just walking in the wrong direction. He says they'll never get to the palace. Realize then that Christianity and Islam, as far as the Maimonides is concerned, they brought all these people and point them in the right direction. Which means if 4,000 years ago the Messiah would have come, it's a very funny thought. But if 4,000 years ago the Messiah would come and say to the world, guess what? You know, we have reached a time now of world peace. What would your average pagan have said? Peace? Why do I want world peace? Think about it, pagans. How would they have responded to world peace? A vision of people, a brotherhood of man. Do you think your average pagan would have liked that? Deep in the pagan mindset was a worldview that might makes right. If you are stronger than somebody else, that means that you are right. That's the pagan worldview. If you would have said to them, how about world peace, that all people live together in peace and harmony? They said, what are you talking about? If you would have come over to a pagan and talked about world peace, they would have stabbed you in the eye and killed you for being weak and probably eaten you for dinner afterwards. I'm not exaggerating. That's what the world was. The fact is today, there are billions of people on this planet and you can talk to them about world peace and they all agree that that's a wonderful thing. You're talking about a kingdom of God on earth. They think that's a wonderful thing. There may be very different approaches on how they think to get there, but look what has happened. 4,000 years after Abraham, we do see billions of people who are now following the plan. Which means if the Messiah were really to come tomorrow, all the Christians in the world will understand what the Messiah is and say, okay, I guess we made a mistake. But at least they understand what you're talking about. They understand what the commandments are. They understand what the Sabbath is. They understand all sorts of things. Again, not with complete understanding, but they're in the ballpark. They understand what's happening. Same thing with Islam, which means Maimonides, that's exactly what he's saying. He says that these religions took pagans and took them closer to true understanding of God. And therefore, that was God's absolute desire. But realize that only takes place during the second temple, during the exile after the second temple period, when these religions spread, which means when we did not live up to our standard, what we were supposed to do was create an elevated society, we didn't do it. Yeah.
Christianity worships an idol as Jesus.
It's actually much more complex than that, and now it's not the time I'll go into it. I agree with you that Christianity may not be monotheistic. Maimonides agrees with you that they're not monotheistic, but they think they're monotheistic, which means they put a value in monotheism. That's already enough that if you would talk to them about pagans, oh no, pagans, those are terrible things. But that's exactly the point. That's precisely Maimonides' point. That they're far better than they were, but they're not where they should be yet. Which means that we have a historical process which has been going on over here leading people towards true understanding. By the way, once you understand this, then you realize the incredible historical responsibility that Jews have today coming back to the land. But this is the third opportunity. This is a third opportunity of creating a different sort of a society, creating an elevated society which will influence other people. That's very simply stated. That's what we're doing here right now. But it seems to be that there was something within the core which already took place in Genesis which allowed things to fall apart, and that was the story with Joseph and the brothers. Also, there's a very interesting comment by Rashi in the beginning of Parshat Vayeshev. It says over here, Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz Meguri Aviv, that Yaakov settled in the land where his fathers dwelled. Now, there's a difference between settling and dwelling. Settling sounds more comfortable. Dwelling sounds more temporary. So over here, Rashi says, Vayeshev Yaakov, Rashi says that Yaakov desired to sit in tranquility. Bikesh Yaakov v'sheves b'shalva. Yaakov desired to sit in tranquility. Kofatz olav rogzo shel Yosef. And the anger, or the anger of the episode, of Joseph jumped him. Tzadikim evakshim l'shev v'shalva. Righteous people want to sit in tranquility. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, God says, L'dayim l'tzadikim ashem etukan lahem la'olam haba. Isn't it enough that which the righteous people have prepared for them in the future? Elishim evakshim l'shev v'shalva olam hazeh. And they also want to sit in tranquility in this world. It's very strange, Rashi. Rashi's telling us that when it says Yaakov settled, that Yaakov, perhaps it's seen his mission coming to an end. And unexpectedly, he had one last chapter in his life that he just never saw coming. Which means, if you were to suggest to Yaakov that he would one day have a falling out with his brother Esav, would he have expected that? Of course. From their youth, there was already tension in the family. From the time that he had to go and take the blessings from his brother, there was tension. From the day that he ran away from his brothers and his brother said, I'm going to kill him, there was tension. Which is Yaakov knew that that's something which have to be dealt with at some point in his life. He goes off, he runs away, he gets married, he has his father-in-law who tries to rip him off left and right. So Yaakov eventually beats his father-in-law, he comes back, placates his brother, and settles. So he figures that's it. But he never anticipated this problem to take place within his own family. He didn't see that coming. One of my teachers once, Rabbi Soloveitchik, he insisted that this Rashi over here is actually taken much deeper. He said what Rashi really believed was at this point the Messianic age could be here. That's what it means that Yaakov, one second, it says Yaakov wanted to live in tranquility. Does that mean that Yaakov wanted to retire? Buy a new house near the golf course, get up and play every day, have the easy life, the good life. Yaakov's a spiritual person, not just a person. Yaakov's a spiritual giant. When it says that Yaakov wanted tranquility, what kind of tranquility did he want? Was it just that he wanted a personal retirement home or retirement village that he wanted to go to? Or did Yaakov want tranquility for the whole world? There's one more element that you need to understand to see where this is coming from. Abraham, when he was told about the covenant, a long time ago, Abraham was told, your descendants will leave the land, they will be enslaved, they will be abused, and they will come back after 400 years. Right? They will not come back before four generations. And the Torah says both, four generations and 400 years. So which is it? Is it 400 years or four generations? And by the way, this is one of the great secrets of Judaism. The answer is, this the Mechilta already brings up, the rabbis discuss this. Depends. Sometimes we can accomplish, in a very short period of time, that which historically should take hundreds of years. And sometimes it could take us hundreds of years to accomplish that which should be accomplished in a very short period of time. Time is something man has to work with. Time could be our greatest asset or our greatest enemy. Which means, let's look at Jacob for a second. I know that I'm not being that clear right now. Jacob can say to himself that what has happened over here is that Abraham was promised that one of his descendants would be enslaved. Okay, he was enslaved. Look at the way that his father-in-law treated him. If you're going to say that Jacob says that he was abused, he was abused. At the end of four generations, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and now the generation of his children, fourth generation is back in the land of Israel. As far as Jacob is concerned, the one thing which has always been at the foremost of his mind has been the promise that God made to Abraham. At this point, everything has taken place. Everything's been fulfilled. There's nothing else has to happen. Which means he understands that the enemy could have been his brother, who was absolutely evil. He understands the enemy could have been Lavan, his father-in-law, who as far as he was concerned was evil. But he never anticipated that the enemy could be within his own family. That's what caught him by surprise. If you want to look at this in even a deeper manner, let's try this. Abraham's great teaching in the world was the teaching of chesed. Abraham taught the world kindness. Yitzchak's great teaching, according to the mystical authorities, is something which is called gvura, strength. Yaakov's great skill was one of emes, truth. Chesed, gvura, and emes. Those of you who know a little bit about mystical terminology know that these three terms, chesed, gvura, and teferes, or emes, are elements of the ten spheres, the ten manifestations that God has on earth, for a very simple reason. That Avraham teaches something godly to the world. Yitzchak teaches something godly. Yaakov teaches something godly. One step further. Abraham and Isaac, Avraham and Yitzchak, represent, in a sense, a dialectic. That these are opposite traits of one another. Avraham, one of chesed, reaching out and helping other people. Yitzchak, one of gvura, which is pulling back, Ezu gibar kovish es yitzro. What is considered real gvura? Somebody who practices self-control. Avraham goes out to others, Yitzchak pulls into himself. I'll try to explain why this happens. Yaakov represents the synthesis between the two. Yishmael is, and I mentioned this last week, Yishmael is a counterfeit of Avraham. Avraham is real chesed, real kindness, really concerned about others. The Medrash tells us that Yishmael used to go around and try to seduce women and say to them, don't you want to be practice chesed like my father taught? You want to do real chesed, you should sleep with me. That was his pickup line. Is that he confused real chesed, which means helping somebody else, with a selfish type of an action where you're trying to take from somebody else. And he insisted this is what chesed is. Yitzchak, growing up in a family, seeing the counterfeit of chesed, creates a new spiritual manifestation in this world, which is the opposite of his father. His father is one of chesed. He goes, no, complete self-control. The world has chesed, now the world needs self-control, in a sense, in order to counter that which was taught by Yishmael. Yishmael, therefore, by the way, represents the counterfeit of real chesed is sexual sins. Go one step further. Yitzchak is one of gvura. What is gvura in Jewish terms? Self-control. That is what strength is. Self-control. In Judaism, the strong person is not the person who can conquer many armies, can conquer many nations. In Judaism, the strongest person, the hero in the Jewish world, is the person who can practice self-control. And of course, you appreciate the difference. In the pagan world, which all of us were brought up in, it's the hero who has all of the conquests. In Judaism, the hero has the conquests. The conquest took place privately where maybe no one else knows about it. The hero can be the hero because of conquest that he took place when no one else was looking, because he conquered his own inclinations to do things which were against the Torah. That is what a Jewish hero is. To practice self-control. His son, Esav, again, is superficial and says, my father is into gvur, is into strength. Therefore, he becomes a soldier, he becomes a hunter, he becomes a killer. Again, a superficial manifestation. But here we have Yishmael teaching the world the counterfeit of chesed, which really is sexual sins. Esav teaching the world the counterfeit of strength, which becomes murder. Yaakov teaches the world truth. He combines the two of them together, creating one force. And now you also understand why in Yaakov's mind there should not have been anything past that. There should have been Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. That's it. There need not be anything else. Yaakov, who brings together the positive aspects of both, the synthesis of Avraham and of Yitzchak, teaches the world truth. All this is truth. The problem is that there can even be a counterfeit to this. The counterfeit is one which we don't find among Yaakov's children. The counterfeit we actually find later on, the counterfeit to the Jewish people, which is the Erev Rav. The Erev Rav are the hangers-on, those who leave Egypt together with the Jews. Those are the ones who were guilty of the golden calf. Which means if you have an all-embracing philosophy, which brings together the positive sides of Avram and Yitzchak, the negativity which can come forth is the negativity of a philosophy which is too all-embracing, which even includes idolatry. Which means, therefore, that if you look at these three things that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov should have taught, which were chesed, kindness, gvura, self-control, the strength of self-control, and the ability of tferis, which is the way it's called sometimes in Kabbalism, the beauty of everything, or emes, to find the truth, to be able to combine things together, that the negativity of the counterfeit to these three are what? Murder. Well, let's go in order. Sexual sins, murder, and idolatry. Actually, if you want to go one step deeper, what was the first sin the world ever saw? What? Even before that?
Temptation.
And what was the sin?
Eating from the tree.
Good. The action of the sin was eating from the tree, but what was the sin? Which means, if God says don't do that, and you can listen to something other than God, that already has the seeds of idolatry to it. Especially in the Garden of Eden, with God manifest right there. Which means, in a sense, the first sin that takes place in the history of the world is a sin of idolatry. The second sin, Cain and Abel, is murder. The third sin that takes place, we find throughout the generation of Noah. We find it says right there that the powerful men take any of the women that they want. Which means the very core of the world had these three sins. Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were supposed to create a world which did not have these type of sins, which, if you realize, are really the core of all pagan behavior. Which means if we get to the end of Yaakov's life, he believes, that's it. Everything now has been fixed. What he never anticipated was the possibility that something else can take place within the family. That Joseph and the brothers could not get along and create this whole new terrible spiritual dynamic. By the way, when the Jews leave Egypt and they stand by Mount Sinai and they make a golden calf, right there by the golden calf you have idolatry. It says then that there was a man named Hor who tried to stop them and they killed him. You have murder. It says that all the people then got up and started to party and said that there were sexual relations going right there. All three of those sins took place by the foot of the mountain. When you realize that, you realize to what extent the golden calf was something which was had so much negative power to it. Talmud tells us that had there not been a sin of the golden calf, the Jews never would have been exiled. Once the Jews in the desert decided to attach themselves, instead of the spiritual legacy of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to the spiritual legacy of perhaps Yishmael and Esav, and the Erev Rav, once they attach to the negative spiritual, to the counterfeit of these three things, it therefore becomes a part of the collective spiritual consciousness of the people, and that's why the first temple is going to be destroyed. The rabbis are very clear about that. First temple never would have been destroyed had there not been for the sin of the golden calf, because the sin of the golden calf had within it all of these three elements. But that's only the first part of it. What was it that Jacob never anticipated that there could be a sin within the family? The second temple is a whole new experience. The second temple now represents the relationship between the Jewish people themselves. Although it's interesting for us to note that eventually, even the first temple, what happened before it was destroyed, we had a civil war. Which means we already had this problem of Joseph and the brothers, we already had the civil war there. The second temple, apparently, God is willing to say, murder, these other things, sexual sins, idolatry, okay, forget about all that. It was the fact that they were able to sin in terms of their interpersonal relationship which destroyed that second temple. And that's something which is really unbelievable for us to consider. Yeah?
If Jacob didn't get along with his own brother, why is it so inconceivable that...
It's not a question of inconceivable. I said this in passing before, because Jacob saw clearly that his brother was evil. His brother was superficial. His brother did not really seem to have very many redeeming qualities. But when he looked at his own kids, and he thought he understood them properly, he saw each one of these are really good people, but with flaws. And he never anticipated that there would be something so profound to take place within the family, which means there is a fundamental difference between somebody who's evil versus somebody who really considers to be good, and that's why it caught him without anticipating it.
You said that toward others, at the beginning of the season,
Right.
And what about
I don't think so.
No, I
understand that. If you're in the Garden of Eden, God says not to do something, and you do something other than what God tells you to do, that means that in your mind there are other forces in the world other than God. Meaning the reality, think deeply for a second. Reality, there is nothing other than God. Ein od milvado, there is nothing other. We, however, make mistakes and we give significance to all sorts of things other than God. When we give these things significance, we create them as realities, but are they reality? They're not, which means that the second that Adam is willing to give into his own inclination, he's creating that as something other than God, and that is tantamount to idolatry. The good inclination is our desire to connect to God, not to something other than God, to connect to God. So that's obviously something which is positive. So if we get back now to the sin of Joseph and the brothers, first thing we have to note is that the starting point of the entire sin is that Joseph, which says, used to talk about them. Back to what I said earlier about Lashon Hara. The core is Lashon Hara. You want to do something really practical over the next 3 weeks leading up to Tisha B'Av, something really practical? Don't speak about other people. Most practical thing in the world. You feel you're about to say something about somebody else, positive, negative. Hold on. Change the topic to something else. Somebody begins to tell you some sort of gossip about somebody, you stop it, right? You stop it. It's not something that you want to really hear about. The core of the problem of hating one another happens when we speak about other people and we inevitably put them down. That's the starting point. If we're able to stop that vicious cycle, we can really do something very practical about this problem. And by the way, it is doable. The problem is that we come with a mindset that it's not even an issue. Speaking gossip about somebody is a victimless crime. What's the problem? Okay, so I made fun of the way that he looked, the way that she dressed, the way that he talks, the way that... who did it hurt? Just having a little fun. What it does is that it really attacks the very basis of the community when people put down. And again, realize the reasons we're doing it. We're doing it because of our own feelings of inadequacy. And if instead of knocking somebody else because we feel inadequate, if instead we're able to pick ourselves up and make ourselves into better people, we would have no need to put somebody else's down. So realize that, ironically, as you put somebody else down deeply, you'll feel that inadequacy even more so, and you're just entering into a vicious cycle, and never be able to get out of it. Yeah?
Why did you mention also positive?
Excuse me?
Why did you also...
Why did I say also not say positive things about people?
Yes.
Because it depends who you say it to. If you say something really positive to somebody who doesn't like them, then it's just as bad as saying something negative. Because they will inevitably respond and say, "Hold, they're not that good. What are you talking about? I'm just saying to be careful."
Yeah, absolutely.
Which means you should speak about other people when there's a purpose, when there's a reason for it. You want to go to a doctor, right? And you say, "Okay, I have this problem. I'm going to go to this doctor." He says, "Hold it. I went to that doctor. I don't think he treats that thing so well." You got to say that? Absolutely. But just to talk about somebody for no purpose, there's no justification in it. There's no reason for it. It doesn't get you anywhere. And as I said, even the positive things about people will end up leading someone else to end up putting them down. Look, that's a little bit more of a gray area. Where I can tell you where it's not gray area, saying something positive in front of somebody who you know is not that friendly with them and will put them down, then for sure it's a problem. But that's why I included that. So we then think... The story of Joseph and the brothers, it happened a long time ago. Shouldn't affect us all that much. It's very interesting, at the end of the whole story, we're told that Benjamin and Joseph embraced and they cried on each other's shoulders. We're told that Joseph cried for the two temples that would be in Benjamin's lot, in his portion of land, and would be destroyed, and that Benjamin cried for the Mishkan, the temporary temple that would be in Joseph's land, in Shechem, and would be destroyed. You know, when the rabbis tell you things like that, they say, "What are they talking about?" So realize that Joseph and Benjamin come to understand that what got played out in the book of Genesis is not just a story of ancient history. It's not just a myth. It's not just a story. It's something which is far more than that. The actions of what takes place in Genesis creates historical realities for the future. I'm going to say something right now that I can't necessarily prove, or certainly not prove that easily. I believe that had the brothers and Joseph gotten along, the Second Temple never would have been destroyed. It's hard to argue that, but I'll just tell you my simple logic. The reason for the Second Temple's destruction is because people hated one another. The core of people hating one another within a family, of brothers hating one another, is Joseph and the brothers. Joseph and the brothers never hated one another. There never would have been that core. There never would have been that core. It never would have manifested itself. The fact that the rabbi is able to say that Joseph and Benjamin, they cry on each other's shoulders, it seems to be telling us that they're sensitive to that. They understand that. They appreciate that. And I know that it's a funny way for us to look at biblical stories, because some of us were brought up that biblical stories are myths and things that happened a long time ago. For Jews, the biblical stories are something which create realities. Things that they did a long time ago create realities for us in the future. Ultimately, the brothers were supposed to accept Joseph, rally around Joseph, and the whole of Jewish history would have been different. And I know this sounds somewhat strange. Joseph was the number one son of the woman that Jacob loved, Rachel. He had another wife named Leah. Jewish history would have been very different if the children of Leah and the children of Rachel were able to come together, join together, and form a wonderful coalition. The problem was, and this is an amazing thing, the brothers absolutely underestimated who Joseph was. You know how I know that? When they finally meet up with Joseph after many years, he is now the second most powerful man in Egypt. Here's a guy who the brothers thought was a complete loser. They threw him in a pit. They sold him off as a slave. You know, whenever I read that story, I say to myself, why don't they know it's Joseph? It says in the Torah that he lines them up in the right order, chronological order of all ten sons. Why aren't they thinking it's Joseph? It's just an obvious thing. It must be Joseph. Okay, some years have passed. He looks different. You know why? Because they never thought for a second Joseph was capable. Do you think that if they realized that Joseph could have become the second most powerful man in Egypt in a fairly short amount of time, you think they would have gotten rid of him so quickly? They would have said, hold it, maybe there's something we can do with this guy. Just be pragmatic. Look in terms of utility. But by the way, realize now that that's the core of hating one another. You don't even realize the capability of somebody. You become blinded to the greatness of other people. You know, when you meet people, sometimes the people you like, sometimes the people you don't like. You want a tool? Every single person you meet, you have to say, okay, start off, say, well, as strange as it may sound, almost every person you'll ever meet, their mother loves them. Why does the mother love the kid? She sees something that other people don't see. She sees the positive within him. Sometimes we get so caught up in ego issues that we become blinded to greatness in other people. When we become blinded to the greatness of other people, it's not just them that we're putting down. It's ourselves that we're destroying through the poison that goes on in our mind. But ultimately, what we're destroying is the community. Because the community needs the greatness of each person. When we're told the Second Temple is destroyed because they couldn't get along with one another, that's just a very practical result. If each person does not appreciate the greatness of somebody else, of course you can't form as a nation. That directly destroys it in the most practical manner. What we have to do as a nation, I'm saying this is especially important now, both in terms of politically what goes on in the world right now, negotiations, Jerusalem's future. By the way, all of that is just to help us focus a little bit more. You can't imagine people that 10, 15 years ago said, I don't get it. Why are we still fast on Tisha B'Av? Such a silly thing. Jerusalem is ours. We don't need to fast anymore. We're a free, independent nation right now. We have no problems. Okay, so God sends us a little message. Jerusalem is still under siege. If you don't realize, the entire state of Israel right now is not in a very good position. No one knows what's going to be the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. And everybody tells you they know exactly what, I mean, either the person's a prophet or completely out of their minds. People don't know what's going to happen. We have over here this incredible capability, but the core of it is to be able to really appreciate the strength and the greatness of other people. If we're not capable of doing that, then we can't possibly build a type of a society which could impact other nations. Or other people could look at us and say, wow, that really is special. We're supposed to build a utopia over here. God gave us the Torah. God gave us the skills. God gave us the tools. We have to realize that every single person has within them God-given capability. Every single person has within them a soul, an neshama, an image of God, a manifestation of God. And therefore, every single person has something which is incredibly precious. When I look at somebody and I can't stand that person, I have to realize that part of what I'm rejecting is a godly aspect within that person. And then I have to realize that there's not a problem with them as much as there's a problem with me. Especially during these 3 weeks leading up to Tisha B'Av, we have to be particularly sensitive on this issue. And if this class today accomplished nothing other than have you think twice before you listen to something negative about somebody else, before you believe something negative about somebody else, or before you say something negative about somebody else, then I would have accomplished a lot.